Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another episode or another session of Al-Landaniyah. Today we're going to go on to Revelation and the Prophets, which are two things we need to establish as Muslims. Now, just to remember or to remind ourselves of what we covered in the previous session, we spoke about God's existence. We went through some arguments, namely the contingency argument. Today we're going to be trying to establish the prophethood of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and the truth of the Quran, which is a very staple part, obviously, of the objective, because we're not just trying to get people to believe in one God, but the fact that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was actually a true prophet, and also that the Quran is the final revelation revealed to mankind. But for that, we need evidence, and obviously today we're going to be going through some of those evidences. So the first thing we're going to be going through is some categories. Now, one distinction that should be kind of thought of is the sufficient/necessary conditions distinction, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. If I say something is required as a necessary condition, I mean that if it's not there, then the condition can never be met, or that the thing can never be met in and of itself. For example, if I say that if I wanted to get married, and you know, it's necessary for another human being, namely a female, to be there, that's a necessary condition, otherwise I can't be married. However, for it to be a sufficient condition, in order for my marriage to count, Islamically speaking, for example, there has to be, for example, like, you know, two witnesses, and the mahar has to be there, and the wali has to be there. So the existence of the woman is a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient condition, because otherwise it would be a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. You know, obviously, which is not allowed in Islam. I'm giving an Islamic example, obviously, you guys can understand it. But for it to be a sufficient condition, I have to fulfill the other criterion, or the pillars of nikah, which are three pillars, namely the mahr, the two witnesses, and the wali. If these three things are met, then marriage is done. Okay, and obviously her consent, that and your consent, and that's I'm taking that into consideration. Now, these are conditions. These are sufficient and necessary conditions. Now, we're going to go through some necessary conditions, but many of you already know them. So we're going to go through them quickly for revelation. What are the necessary conditions? And we're going to go through the sufficient conditions. When we talk about sufficient conditions now, we are going to be referring to a different kind of framework. Like, when we were arguing for God's existence, we were arguing deductively, sometimes from first principles. With this, is a little bit different, because now we are going to argue probabilistically, meaning we are going to infer to the best explanation, and this is referred to as abductive reasoning. It's inference to the best explanation. When you make an inference to the best explanation, this is called abductive reasoning, and this is a kind of probabilistic rationalization. And most of the things we do includes this level of what you call epistemic probabilistic reasoning. So, things that you've done today, everything that you've done today, almost everything, kind of implies that. Like when you woke up and then you stood up, you know, you went to the toilet or whatever you did, you know, had a shower, pressed the button for the shower, this is going to work. You know, you went into the car, you started driving the car, this is going to work. Why? Because it's worked yesterday, it's worked the day before. If it wasn't a car, then, you know, on the tree, sat there waiting for the train or waiting for whatever, this is going to happen, it's going to come. There's a train there. You believe that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting there. Imagine if people didn't believe that trains were coming, where they sit on the bus stop. What kind of fools would they be? You know, so we employ a probabilistic reasoning in life without having to do any kind of total probability actual calculations. We don't sit there and say, well, actually, what's on a Bayes theory or total probability mathematical theory, what's the chances that this will happen or that? Sometimes we do that. Maybe when people gamble, they do that. But otherwise, they don't really do that. People live their life using epistemic probability, and using that, they come to conclusions, almost intuitive, you know, without reference to anything else in their day-to-day life. You go on your phone, you call somebody, or you expect someone to answer or not. You expect there to be a connection or not. You expect when you go on a plane for you not to crash, even though there are some chances that you will crash. When you were in this building right now, we're expecting the building to stay upright. Although, obviously, the lights have switched off. And maybe we expected the lights to stay on. you know, and so on. You know, that. So what we're saying is that we use this kind of reasoning. Now, in terms of necessary conditions, it's really interesting. Wallahi, it's very, very interesting that the Quran is the only ancient religious text that I know of that even has a verse relating to falsification and with respect to contradictions. وَلَوْ كَانَ مِنْ عَنْدِي غَيْرِ اللَّهِ لَوَجَدُوا فِيهِ اخْتِلَافًا كَثِيرًا. If it was from other than God, they would have found in it many contradictions. So the first thing is, a necessary condition for something to be from God, which is the all-knowing, as we've described before, when we said that God is the all-knowing, He's the One, He's the powerful, etc. If something is, the source of it is the all-knowing God, it cannot have contradictions. Now the idea that something that is from an all-knowing God should not have contradictions, the challenge doesn't come anywhere except for the, it's not in the Old Testament, it's not in the New Testament, and it's not in the Bhagavad Gita, it's not in the GGS, it's nowhere to be found, only in the Quran. It's as if the Quran at least acknowledges that if a revelation is to be from God, it has to be internally and externally consistent. Because this would be undermining the knowledge, the supposed knowledge, the perfect knowledge of God, if there is not internal consistency to a perfect degree. So the Quran challenges people to find contradictions within the book. Moreover, in addition to that, the Quran must be preserved. It has to be preserved. The access of the original people to the Quran has to be the same access that we have. Otherwise, they would have a preferential access to guidance than we do. And if the Quran is meant to be for all peoples in all times, or if the guidance, the final revelation, yeah, is meant to be for all peoples in all times, then it has to be accessible to all peoples in all times in its purest and completest of forms. Someone will say, what about people that have not been introduced to the Quran? We know theologically they're not judged in the same way. People that have been Islamically introduced to the Quran and Sunnah and then they reject it have a different ruling altogether, an eschatological ruling, to those who have not been, like in the Aborigine jungle or I don't know where, you know, this place or that place or forest or even those individuals who live within Western societies who have wrong understandings of Islam, or the only exposure they have to Islam is a false understanding to Islam. وَمَا كُنَّا مُعَذِّبِينَ حَتَّى نَبَعَثَ رَسُولًا. We were not going to punish a people until we sent them messengers. So this is to say that if people are not given such messengers and the message has not received to the person, then they should not be judged in the same way as someone who has. So the access point has to be the same. So preservation and internal/external consistency must be prerequisites and necessary conditions for a revelation to be from God. Now, bear in mind, these conditions, which are necessary conditions, are not to be found in the Old Testament or the New Testament, by the admission of the scholars. Almost the consensus, by the way. The consensus of Christian scholars, this is a big thing to mention. Almost the consensus agree now in biblical scholarship, what we call text criticism, that the Bible is completely interpolated and fabricated, and there's layers of fabrication and interpolation. From Athanasius in the 4th century, who is the one who put all the books together, all the way through to the newest translations of the Bible, the New International Version, the Revised Standard Version, the King James Version, this, that, whatever. All of these have different variants, contradictory variants, what to include, what to exclude. We don't have the same. We have so many controversies in Islam. It remains the case that with all of the sects in Islam that oppose each other, no sects, the sects in Islam are not fighting over what the Quran is. You don't find Diobandis and Brelvis and Salafis and Sufis attacking each other. This is the Quran, this is not the Quran. They fight about everything else, but they agree on what the Quran is, correct? Have you ever seen a controversy? No. Whoever comes out with something is usually outcast and thrown out. If someone comes out with this is not the Quran, they're outcast and thrown away. Simple as that. Even with all the controversies in Islam, this is not one of them. It's not one of them. We have qira'at, yes. We have different variations, whatever. These are all qira'at which are agreed upon. Yeah, they are agreed upon. And so, having said that now, that so we said, on the on the two points which are necessary conditions for revelation to be from God, these two points which are necessary conditions are not even found in the other religions. Origen of Alexandria, who wrote a book called On First Principles, and in the back of his book, I remember reading this for the first time, the Butterworth translation, he was referring to the very first page of the Old Testament. And it says, on the first day, obviously, God created the night and the day. On the fourth day, he created the luminaries. And he was saying, what man of intelligence would believe that the night and day was created the first day and the luminaries were created on the fourth? Yani, how could there be night and day without the luminaries? It's what he said. He said, this is why we have to accept this is why we have to look at the Old Testament or the Bible in a spiritual sense. And by that he means metaphorize it. In the book of Genesis chapter 1 verse 11, on the third day, you had vegetation, which is the herbage and so on, being created by God, apparently, right? But in Genesis chapter 2 verse 5, which is the next chapter, you see that no plant had sprung up yet. That's what it said. So were there plants or were there not plants? Recently, William Lane Craig, he put in his Reasonable Faith, he was saying, this is his quote, something to the effect of, it seemed like the author of the Bible didn't care if there were contradictions or not. When I told him that he said that, he tried refuting me and said, well, you know, or he wrote it down, you know, he tried to refute me recently, yeah? He said, well, if I really wanted to, I can see where the follies of the Quran and the contradictions therein. I'm waiting to see this. This is what he said. It's like saying, well, I'll get my dad on you, you know? Okay, just bring the beef, you know, whatever. Just give me the evidence instead of telling me I could do it if I wanted to. Even though his whole career was based on Ghazali, basically, you know, his whole career. If Ghazali was not there, it would be a necessary condition for him to be who he is today. That's not even sufficient. So, and obviously, Ghazali, he wrote a book called Al-Qistas al-Mustaqim. I'm not sure if you know this book, but he basically said that all his arguments, he's bringing ayat from the Quran and saying, these are the logical arguments in the Quran. It's called Al-Qistas al-Mustaqim. He says, look, this is a logical argument, his whole point, the point of the book was to show the logical arguments in the Quran. So, أَمْ خُلِقُوا مِنْ غَيْرِ شَيْمَهُ الْخَالِقُونَ, which acted as a basis for Al-Ghazali's, everything that begins to exist has a cause, the universe has a cause, may have come directly from the Quran. William Lane Craig used the Quran to protect the Bible, and now he's attacking the Quran. Can you imagine this guy? Anyway, that's another guy for another day. You know, and he spelled my name wrong in the refutation as well. He spelled my name wrong, you know. Hajib. It's not Hajib, it's Hijab. And he knows it. He knows my name. But he spelled it wrong just to show that he doesn't know who I am. Anyway, so there are necessary and sufficient conditions. And there are contradictions in the Old Testament. And the whole Bible is not preserved. You can't say any of that stuff about the Quran. There's no argument that can be made. I mean, there are arguments that are made by Orientalists, non-Muslim Orientalists, that talk about general preservation of the Quran. There's no such argument, like-for-like argument, that is made about the Bible. There is no such like-for-like argument that is made about the Bible. So you can say, well, it's debatable if the Quran is preserved. The fact that it's debatable that the Quran has no contradictions in it. Fine, it's debatable. Debatable means it could be the case and it couldn't be the case. With the Bible, we know for a fact it's not the case. So it's not even debatable, it's consensus. So it's eliminated. You've eliminated the Bible. We've eliminated it with the Trinity, and you've eliminated it with this as well. Okay? Now, having said that, we are going to go into some of the evidences now. We've talked about the necessary conditions. Now we are going into the sufficient conditions. Let's think about this together. So I've divided, okay, into three types. You have Quranic evidence that comes directly from the Quran, and you have extra Quranic evidence. Now some people, they seem not to understand how things work. So they say, well, if you say that some evidence has come outside the Quran, that means you're committing kufr. This is what they say. Some Salafists from the right wing of Salafism, not all of them, of course, but some strands of Madkhalism and so on, they say, if you're saying there's any evidence coming outside the Quran, you're committing kufr because you're saying there's evidence that's better than the Quran. But this is a weak type of argumentation, not least because there are some things which have been corroborated from outside sources, which the Quran talks about. غُلِبَتْ الرُّوم فِي أَدْنَ الْأَرْضِ هُمْ مِنْ بَعْدِ غَلِبِهِمْ سَيَغْلِبُونَ. The Romans have been defeated. How do you know the Romans have been defeated? And that they will defeat after. You have to go and see outside the Quran if the guy's going to be defeated or not, which is now an evidence, which is a historical evidence outside the Quran. تِلْكَ مِنْ أَنْبَاءِ الْغَيْبِ نُحِيهَا إِلَيْكَ مَا كُنْتَ تَعْلَمُهَا أَنْتَ وَلَا قَوْمُكَ مِنْ قَبْلِ هَذَا فَاصْبِرْ إِنَّ الْعَاقِبَةَ لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. This is Allah, he mentions many things about different prophets, Nuh and different prophets, and he says, these are from the news, this is from the news of the unseen, which you didn't know, or which we reveal upon to you. Yeah? مَا كُنْتَ تَعْلَمُ أَنْتَ وَلَا قَوْمُكَ مِنْ قَبْلِ هَذَا. You and your people did not know these things before that. فَاصْبِرْ إِنَّ الْعَقِبَةَ لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. So you have another layer of historical arguments, which once again can be corroborated by outside. Another thing is physical miracles of the Prophet. The physical miracles of the Prophet, where the Prophet did things, you know, and so on. These are things that the Prophet did, which are not Quranic. They're not within the Quran. Obviously, it's within the Prophet's own remit. He was doing this kind of thing. But this is what we mean by extra Quranic. It's not Quran. It's more in line of Sunnah, this one. Yeah, and then you have the Sunnah type evidences, like we said, the prophecies, the historical ones. Today we're going to go through, and also the Prophet himself is, because if you Surah Al-Bayyinah, لَمْ يَكُنُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ وَالْمُشْرِكِينَ مُنْفَكِينَ حَتَّى تَأْتِيَهُمُ الْبَيِّنَةُ رَسُولٌ مِنَ اللَّهِ يَتْلُو صُحُفٌ مُطَهَّرَةٌ. That is Rasul himself is an evidence, because the Prophet himself is an evidence. So his life is an evidence. He's a bayyinah. In fact, he's a very clear evidence. Because when you assess the life of the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ from the beginning to the end, from when he was a young man, young boy, all the way up to when he was a man and a prophet and when he got married and so on, you realize that actually he himself is an evidence. Now, I want you to think about how that is the case. So with the person next to you, I'm going to give you a good time here. I'm going to give you 5 minutes to think about the following question. I'm going to give you very clear parameters, okay? I want you to try and think of the following. If you had 3 minutes to sum up the Prophet ﷺ's life and mission, just life and mission, not going into miracles or that kind of thing just yet. Just life and mission. If you had 3 minutes, someone said, who was the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ? Someone, non-Muslim that you know, asked you, who was the Prophet? You have 3 minutes. What would be the events that you would mention? Okay. What would be the key salient points that you mentioned? So I want to give you 5 minutes with the person next to you to think about like 5 to 7 points, bullet point type thing. And then I'm going to give each of you 2 to 3 minutes to answer that question. Because I think it needs to be fluid on our tongues how we answer this question. Does that sound alright? Alright, 5 minutes, go ahead. I'm going to give you guys time to speak, alright? So everybody's going to get 3 minutes. Everyone's going to get 3 minutes, alright? Because we need to get used to speaking as well. So we'll start on the right and then move around, okay? Okay, go ahead, please.
Okay, so the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I think the first kind of main important event that we should establish is who he was before prophethood. So the fact that he was trustworthy, people in society, they praised him, they accepted him to society, they all trusted him, and also the fact that he was unlettered, and you know, he didn't have an education to be able to read and write. So I think that's the kind of the first main event, you know, who he was before prophethood, and then. So at the age of 40, he was receiving revelation, and his revelation, you know, was from God, and the only thing that he was calling people to was to worship Allah alone, and it was only for this reason. You know, it seems like something which is very simple, but because of this, you know, one message, you know, just to worship Allah alone, the people, they outcast him from society. So just for this message, you know, he didn't want material things, he didn't want, you know, power or anything, because the people, they offered this to him. They offered him material possessions, they offered him power, but then he rejected them all. Why? Because he wanted people to just worship Allah alone. So he wasn't compromising on his message. And then the kind of last event I would mention is kind of after Hijrah, which is in Medina, and kind of, you know, the culmination of his life, where, you know, by the end of his life, people were able to see that he was successful in all areas, in that he was successful as a father, as a husband, as a family man, But then also as a law maker, you know, he brought laws and, you know, principles into the justice system, into politics, into economics, and he and even in war, and he was successful in all of these areas. And then also in prophethood, he was also you know,
just one thing, I'll be careful of using the word lawmaker before I forget, yeah, because obviously we believe the laws come from.
Yeah,
keep going, sir.
Yeah, but yeah, so I think these kind of three areas are good proofs, and you know, if one wants to examine these three areas,
can you repeat
then
the three areas? Yeah.
So the first one being who he was before prophethood, and you know, how he was trusted for society, and then second is, you know, when he was receiving revelation, and then he was outcasted from society, you know, exactly what his message is, him receiving the Quran, even though he was unlettered, he was, you know, reciting these, you know, miraculous words. These words that, you know, the Arab poets couldn't, you know, compete with. And then the third being kind of the culmination of his life and the success that he had in all of these areas at the end.
Yeah. That's good. That's 3 minutes. person next to you, please.
You can start.
Yeah, go ahead.
The brother pretty much covered all the points that we were thinking about, but yeah, so I'll probably be just reiterating what he said. Yeah, so one, I think, yeah, the fact that his character was well and truly established way before he proclaimed prophet is a very important to point out. And then the fact that he was unpleased with the state of affairs in terms of spiritual state of affairs of the society that he was living in, he was extremely uncomfortable with the polytheism that was present there in Mecca at the time. And then also, like the brother mentioned, the fact that he basically had everything at that point, because he was born into a very noble family. He had to give up everything, and in return basically got nothing. He just asked people to worship one God. It's not like he was calling for people to help him out or something. So he basically gave up everything and was persecuted. Just and in return, he only asked people to call for God, to worship God. Sorry, so that's I think another good indication of him being legitimate. And then also just being true to his message, and mission throughout all the persecution, all the suffering that he went through, is another thing that should be pointed out. And then also the fact that until the end of his life, he was he's straight true to his mission, and it's very clear that he wasn't until the very moment that he died, he wasn't expecting in any worldly things in return for what he was asking for from the people. So even if somebody comes to say things like, well, he had 9 wives, and tried to imply that he was living a hedonistic lifestyle, all we have to do is just go back to his life to see that he was a true ascetic in every sense of the word, and the argument that he was a hedonist or something, it just doesn't hold any grounds. I would say his consistency with his consistency and him staying true to his mission, I think it's a key sign of his prophethood.
Okay, you have 30 seconds. You want to end there?
I think I'll end there.
Okay, nice. Next person.
Yeah, so this is if someone asks us like to summarize the life of Prophet. So I'll start by talking about the fact that basically, you know, some simple information in terms of where he came out from. So Prophet was, we believe, sent as a guide, as somebody who was to call the people to the religion of Islam. He was sent to an area in Mecca, a society that was relatively cut off from other areas and was suffering from an immense number of vices. There was sort of sexual lewdness within the community. There was intense problems of tribalism, racism. There was immense sort of warfare over petty matters that were going on within the community. And so his entire lifestyle, his entire life from the beginning of his life until the end is something that the Muslims take guidance from and inspiration from. And it's part of an evidence of his prophethood, in that he was protected from indulging in all of these lewd things even before prophethood. Eventually, at the age of 40, he received the Quran, which is transformative. It's particularly potent because he was unlettered himself, and yet he came forth with something that was linguistically sort of unprecedented in the Arabic language. He begins a spiritual teaching, inculcating values and morals within the people that begin to follow him. And for 13 years in Mecca, he's offered all of these things of the dunya, of the world, money, wealth, power. And he rejects all of it, and he, you know, stays firm, him and his companions, whilst they're being oppressed, abused, tortured. And he's just teaching them these things, and he has nothing to offer them except La ilaha illallah and Tawheed and a reformation of their souls and their character. And they love him and they follow him in that. And he takes nothing from the world either. Eventually, he leaves Mecca and he goes and they make hijrah to another city called Medina to take a refuge there from the hardships that they were suffering. And at this point in time, as he's now the ruler of a political community, as when people begin to march on the community, as a responsibility to defend that community. And so there's a series of battles that then take place, and we see a different sort of aspect of his character, where he is somebody who leads his community not only spiritually but also militarily, politically. And you see the pragmatism, you see his negotiations, you see the way he engaged with all the different tribes of Arabia at that particular time. He fulfills his prophetic mission. And when he leaves Mecca, he leaves sort of with the promise or the aspiration that he will eventually return. And he eventually returns and retakes the city and establishes it as a place of monotheism, as opposed to polytheism. And most potently, before he passes away, he gives his companions the responsibility of taking this message of Islam to the rest of the world. And so even after he dies, there's an evidence really of the tremendous achievement of his life, that he not only was an immense leader in himself, but he created leaders and he created people that came afterwards that took the message of Islam and gave birth to an immense and amazing civilization of people.
Beautiful. Okay, before we continue to the rest, I want us to create a model answer. So can we have everyone taking notes, bullet point notes, on what's already been said, so that we can have some, if there's something that's missed out, and then, you know. So what were some of the points that were made already? I can't see you. Just shout out. Don't worry.
He was a great military leader, teacher, husband, father, general, family man in general.
Okay, let's try and get this in chronology, though. So you're right, definitely. But let's start with Mecca first before we go to Medina. So what were some of the main things that were said about in Mecca?
Prophethood. So even prior to prophethood, him being unlettered and everything, he was deemed trustworthy by everybody.
Yeah, all right, brilliant. So trustworthy and unlettered. So do you want to put that down, so that he was unlettered? Why is unlettered, why is that significant?
Because what was to come later will indicate, you know, some sort of truth to the claim that he is, you know, a prophet of God.
Why would that? Why is that the case?
Because he would have been outside the influence of right. literature and
right.
So they couldn't say that he read such and such and exactly. that influenced him.
Good point. Right. So let's put that point down. Let's put down a Sadiq al-Amin, the truthful and the trustworthy one. Yeah. Now let's be a little bit critical here. What if someone were to ask, well, what is the evidence that he was a Sadiq al-Amin? That he was actually the truthful one and the trustworthy one? What would someone, how do you prove, so you're making that claim, but how can we prove that he was a Sadiq al-Amin, the truthful one, the trustworthy one?
Sorry, you can say that before his prophethood, the warring tribes of Arabia used him as an arbitrator.
Brilliant, excellent. Yeah, so he was...
Because he had such a good reputation.
Beautiful.
Particularly with the example of the laying the black stone in its place in the Kaaba. Mm. And he basically, the other tribes, aggressive, you know, they were fighting each other, but they trusted him. And he recommended that, you know, they all take the black stone in a cloth.
Yes.
And each hold a corner of the cloth. Mm. And then he himself was chosen to put the black stone in its correct place.
And that shows that they trusted him.
Exactly.
Beautiful. Any other points on trust? Just shout out, because I can't see anyone's hand.
But his wife as well. Mm-hmm. Before his prophethood, his first marriage, his wife saw he was a trustworthy person in business.
When
his wife Khadija.
Yes.
And she was so she was so impressed by his character and trustworthiness.
Yes.
Obviously, she saw how he did business that she chose him as her husband.
Beautiful.
And
excellent. This is definitely corroborating. Anything else? P people would leave their stuff with him, you know, for collection. Do you know about this?
Yeah.
So can you elaborate upon it?
I don't know details, but yeah, the people, they would entrust him with their belongings, like when they would go on like trips, and he'd look after them. And this was actually even after he claimed to be a prophet, they continued to trust him with you know, their possessions.
Excellent. There's also a verse in the Quran, وَلَقَدْ لَبِثْتَ فِيكُمْ sorry, لَقَدْ لَبِثْتُ فِيكُمْ عُمُرًا مِّن قَبْلِهِ فَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ, and that I had lived before prophethood a whole lifetime before it, do you not think? Yeah. Now, if you think about what the Quran is going to be a public declaration. So if the Quran is making a public declaration that, you know, the prophet lived a whole life before you, if this statement was going to stir controversy, it would not have been made, if that makes sense. Like, if people are going to say, we knew you to be a bad character, and we knew you to be like a dishonest person or something like that. The fact that we don't have any report from any antagonist or any enemy of Islam to indicate that the Prophet was known for lying, even despite the fact that the Quran makes declarations to the fact of his character, وَإِنَّكَ لَعَلَى خُلُقٍ عَظِيمٍ, that you are of impeccable character, is indicative of the fact that this was a given that the Quran was publicly announcing, rather than something of controversial quality. Like when the Quran makes the statements about his impeccable character and his trustworthiness or whatever it may be, it doesn't do so in an argumentative way or persuasive format. It does so in an informative way, which the expression of which is not intended to stir any type of controversy, which we know it didn't. Does that make sense? Or not?
Yeah?
Alright, so we talked about Sadiq al-Amin, the fact that he is the truthful and the trustworthy one. What else can we say in the Meccan period? Just in the, what else was mentioned? You mentioned some key terms: tribalism, racism. What else kind of thing was mentioned?
I think the Prophet also mentioned the fact that he was unlettered, and the society at the time, they were very involved in like poetry, and they used to, you know, compete at, you know, elite levels with each other in poetry. So this was something that, you know, the Arabs at the time, they took very serious.
Right. But write down also what we just mentioned. So tribalism, racism, okay?
Yeah.
Put that in your notes because it's very important. Tribalism, racism, okay? And infanticide, the idea of killing young girls. I'm not sure if that was mentioned, but these are the kinds of things that were typical in the Meccan environment. Obviously, the Quran and the Hadith come explicitly in opposition to these things, yeah? What other things in Mecca that could be thought about?
There was a, if I remember correctly, there was a lot of lewdness, like lewd behavior. I don't remember a lot of the details, but there was practices. For example, an Arabian woman would have intercourse with several men, and then once she's pregnant, she will simply choose out of the bundle of men who is the father of her offspring. There was a lot of this going around, and he abstained. He was, you know, a virgin until marriage at the age of 25 to Khadija.
Good. So he was chaste. You know, this is a good point. This is a very good point. He was pure. There's actually a very interesting story in the Sirah, in the Meccan period, where the Prophet was going on his way to a gathering. And I'm not sure if you've come across the story, but basically, he fell asleep before he could get there. He fell asleep before he could get there, and he recalls it being like Allah has saved him from going to that gathering because there was haram elements there, basically. So even at that time, God was guiding him and stuff. So the chastity element, the purity element, is a big part. And obviously, the his heart was being purified as a child. Think about his upbringing. What kind of upbringing did he have? Did he have a nuclear family? Or was he something else? What was he? Begin with O.
He was an orphan.
He was an orphan. This is important. Because it humanizes the character of the Prophet Muhammad. You know, we have to mention this. You know, the Prophet Muhammad was an orphan. Okay? He grew up, you know, with his uncle. You know. And he married a woman that was older than him. Some reports say 5 years older. Some say 15 years older. Khadija was much older than him, you know. And if you just look at the very sensitive and innocent way they got married, he was no arrogant man, womanizer like they make out. He was, you know, the way that he approached Khadija was so innocent, like it was through a third party, and he didn't think that she would, you know, she would love him or that she would like him or whatever. And the same thing back with her, and then it was made into a union in a very natural, and he went to the family. You know, this shows like honor. There's this deep level of honor there, don't you feel? Okay. Anything else that was already mentioned by this side before we go to this side? Sorry, because I'm getting involved too much, I think. On what was also mentioned on this side, and in terms of the Meccan, yeah.
Cave Hira, when he used to go to contemplate in the cave.
That hasn't been mentioned yet, so you can put that in your answer. That's fine. Yeah. You can say he had a meditative temperament.
No.
You know, he did have a meditative temperament. He wasn't. Once again, he went in isolation, think about things today in the cave. You know.
Still before prophethood.
Yeah, this is Meccan period, the whole Meccan period, including prophethood. Yeah.
Anything mentioned about how even during that period they had a lot of rituals and things like that around the Kaaba, a lot of shirk, a lot of polytheism, and he had...
No, but you can mention this. You can mention this. Okay. Is a new point. But from what the brothers have mentioned already, is there anything we've missed out so far?
Yeah, I'm not sure how far ahead we're going, but we did mention that even after him claiming to be a prophet, they offered him...
Right, this is a very important point. Yeah, so they offered him what? Go on.
Yeah, they offered him like riches. They offered him, women for marriage. They offered him power. They even offered compromising, like, you know, we will worship your God in one day, and you know, but on the other days, we'll worship our gods. So they made the compromising efforts to try and persuade him away from his message.
This is very important because a liar, when they're met with this kind of thing, they usually take it like... If you're doing it for materialistic purposes, they said they'll make you the Sayyid, they'll make you the leader of the place, they'll give you women, they want women, we'll give you this, we'll give you that. You know, these negotiations were being had, and if this is what he wanted, he could have gotten it.
Yeah.
This is actually a very important point, because why would someone do this? What is the motivation of doing something like this? You know, if it's for material gain, then he was offered material gain, and he rejected material gain. This is very important. He rejected material gain. And, you know, you mentioned, I think some of you mentioned, that he lived a life of poverty. In fact, he did. And I think one of the most powerful, and maybe it could be some kind of homework we do for the next session or something, one of the most powerful hadiths, there's two or three that indicate to this reality. One of them is that when Umar ibn al-Khattab went into the house and he saw the Prophet, and, you know, he's been sleeping on this kind of straw mattress. And the lines, the straw lines were on his back. And he said, look at these great kings. You know, they have been given everything, and you, and look at you, basically. He said that they've been given the riches of this dunya, but I'm not opting for that, basically. I can get you the full hadith, exactly what he said. You know. But this kind of thing is really powerful, because his wife... Aisha said that we lived on two black things, meaning we lived on water and dates. We weren't living on like luxurious foods and middle-class lifestyles. It's not what was happening. But this is going more in the Medina period. Let's give the rest of the brothers some time, 3 minutes each, yeah? Go ahead, we'll start with whoever's right most with the fluorescent jacket. Start with you.
So just mention things that wasn't mentioned.
Yeah, mention as much, whatever you want. And it will be good if you mention things that were not mentioned as well.
So I was going to just mention like some characteristics of the Prophet ﷺ. So like how he was very contemplated a lot, went to Cave Hira. This was also before prophethood. He spent a lot of time there, away from like the noise of the city of Mecca. And this was also like a form of preparation for prophethood. So he was kind of in his nature to be like that. And also in a sense of higher sense of shyness as well. Wasn't someone like you mentioned, like a womanizer. Like when he was doing the business for Khadija radhiyallahu anha, he wouldn't even go into the house to ask her for the payment, but we sent his friend through instead because of his shyness that he had within his character. And that's also also whilst he was being offered these things in Mecca from the Quraysh, like all these riches and women, things of this nature,
he wasn't just living like an easy lifestyle whilst not taking that. He was also just being persecuted as well. So whilst he was praying in front of the Kaaba, that Abu Lahab came and his companion to like throw the intestines of a camel upon him. And even through like throughout that persecution and stuff like that, at that point he rejected like the riches. It wasn't just they just left him by himself. He was getting persecuted on top of, you know, being offered things of that nature. Also how he was with his companions. So his companions stayed with him in Mecca, Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu. He came to defend the Prophet. And a man of, you know, such stature, was the truthful message that he had with him, like his companions, they went to an extent where, you know, it would be like an evidence to say, to prove that what he was saying was true. Because like, how could you go that far for someone that was just, you know, in it for the dunya? So yeah, that's kind of like a supporting evidence for his prophethood.
And bring in Medina as well, guys. It's not just Mecca here. Bring in everything, yeah? You've got a minute left. If you want to bring anything, you can.
I think I'll just leave it.
Okay.
Can't think right now. No,
no problem. Next.
So, yeah, just to sort of echo everybody in the room, he was an unlettered man who lived in a society where there was a lot of, you know, tribalism, racism, and infanticide and lewdness, you know, going on, which he abstained from. Especially polytheistic and shirky acts, which he also abstained from. He was known for his impeccable character and trustworthiness and truthfulness. He was, I believe into the Medinan period, he was a military leader, fantastic teacher, husband, family man in general, ruler and companion. And, that's what I have so far. Yeah.
Try and add to it because you've only spoken for 1 minute.
So let me just just to reiterate. Add
a few events, add a few things that.
I think one event portrays him in being known as a trustworthy individual. I believe it was on the Mount Safa, the mountain of Safa, where he yelled, you know, "Ya Sabaha," which is an Arabic expression. And he goes, "If I told you that horsemen were advancing to attack you from the valley on the other side of this mountain, will you believe me?" To which they replied, "Yes, we have always found you truthful." Then the Prophet went on to say, "I am a plain warner to you of a coming severe punishment." So that's one example in which he was found to be truthful by people, whether that was his family, friends, critics or enemies. They all found him to be as such.
It's a really good point. And the fact that's a good evidence of his truthfulness and the fact that he was seen as truthful, because that's how they responded, is we always saw you as truthful. It's very good evidence. The Mount Safa was a very good point. Tariq, do you know?
Well, the Prophet, he was a very humble man. And as the brothers have already said, that he was he had impeccable manners and he was known throughout the area as incredibly polite. He'd always greet everybody, strangers or familiar people, with a smile. So, you know, he was known for his character like that. And apart from that, he was also successful militarily, a great general. And one of the nicest stories that I've ever heard is the story of a humble man when he bought the Prophet some grapes, the Prophet was eating the grapes and he didn't offer to his companions any of them. And when they asked, because it's in our cultures to offer anything you have to other people, when the man went away, he said that because the grapes were sour, I didn't want you for the man to see any expression on your face that may hurt his feelings, so I ate the grapes myself. So that's one of the indications of his character.
Yeah.
Also that throughout his life, he never requested any wealth or any kind of anything that was involved in, you know, anything that would be outwardly ostentatious. And he always lived frugally, including when he was at his height of his prophethood. He would live in a room with three. He would live in a house with three rooms, so it would be a guest room, his bedroom, and the washroom. So, and this is a man who could have built, you know, a palace of gold for himself, but to the end of his days, he provided an example for all Muslims to live frugally, and that's what we take as an individual who has impeccable manners and who was humble and an example for all of mankind.
Beautiful, fantastic, Wallahi, it's very excellent. You know, just to add to some of this, I think we're getting closer to that model answer that we want, you know. One of the greatest, or for me anyway, one of the most powerful events in, well, two or three things I want to add actually. Well, first of all, the Prophet, this is a fact, that he buried all of his children except for one. He buried all of his children. It's very easy to come off the tongue, you know. He buried all of his children except for one. He buried his wife, Khadija, and he buried his uncle, but he buried all of his children, all the girls and his sons, etc., except for one. So it's a man who had, and he had been an orphan as a child. Just this by itself, like, we're talking about a man who had experienced life. Like, he had been through grief in life. You know, this is difficult. And I want you to just think about one thing. One of the things that is usually used as an evidence against the Prophet's character is the fact that he engaged in warfare. But the fact that he engaged in warfare once or twice a year, once or twice a year, on average, in his Medinan period only, before that he was being persecuted, right? I think that's an evidence for his prophethood, and I'll tell you why. The reason why is because it was risky business claiming to be a prophet. Like, imagine having to put your life on the line once or twice a year. Like, this is not a matter of, okay, you're claiming to be a prophet and now you're living a luxurious lifestyle. You're claiming to be a prophet and this could lead you to be killed. Once or twice a year, people are going to try and take your life. And this that happened almost. You know, it came close to that in Uhud, for example, where his tooth was broken and they thought he was dead. You know, and this was a defensive battle, actually, just like most of them were, with the exception of one or two, which you can make an exception. The Romans, you can say, was preemptive, although they killed the emissary first, but we can go into those details later on. That's, I think, an evidence for his prophethood. The fact that he was willing to put himself in these life or death situations. And connected to that is the fact that Allah in the Quran, he proclaims that he will defend him and he will safeguard him despite all of those attempts on his life. Wallahu ya'simuka minan nas. Allah, he will protect you against the people. So in other words, there's a godly protection being offered here. And it's a guarantee. It's a godly guarantee. So that's another thing. So he, just to summarize the points here, he buried all his children except for one. He buried his wife. He went through intense grief in his life, persecution in his life. And in the time when he was the leader of a country, he was being his life was being challenged once or twice a year. And when he was living in that state, he was living in poverty. This was a leader who had been living in poverty. Now they say nine wives. Nine wives at one time is no joke. In fact, this is exactly what a womanizer doesn't do. Sorry to say. When they say, well, you know, he had nine wives at one time. Yeah, he did have nine wives at one time. All of them were divorcees and widows, except for one, which is Aisha. Yeah, he had nine wives at one time. All of them were with him until he died. So he maintained nine women at one time. And the reasons, obviously, we know, tribal, to get the tribes together, and to, you know, all that things. But let's just focus on the fact that he had nine women at one time. A womanizer doesn't commit to relationships. That is a rule. A womanizer, that he goes from one woman to the next. He uses the woman and he goes to the next. He doesn't want to contribute to her life. He doesn't want to take care of her. That's not what a womanizer does. womanizers are the most afraid of commitment. But having 9 women at one time means he's committed to 9 women's health, safety, protection, physical, psychological, and so on. They're learning at one time. He is elevating their status in society in a way that nothing else could have. So these arguments that you always find that the arguments that are used against the Prophet are the best arguments for his prophethood. Or he was a warlord, or he was, whatever, or a womanizer. But when you really think about it, you realize that actually, it's not the case. And just on the point of warlord, since this video probably will go out after I've spoken to Peterson, who had made that comment. I mean, the problem is with this comment is that warlord indicates, the term warlord indicates that the Prophet, he got power through aggressive and violent means. That's how dictionaries define it. But the Prophet did not gain power through violent and aggressive means. The Prophet Muhammad, he went to Ta'if, as you guys know, and this is a very important event. He went to Ta'if by himself. Okay, he didn't go with an army. And when he went to Ta'if, he was pelted and violently rejected by his people. Ta'if happened before the migration to Medina. And he was rejected violently, almost killed, actually. And then he went to Al-Aws wal-Khazraj, two groups of people who embraced Islam through a religious incentive and made him into a political leader. Through popular support, he gained leadership. He didn't gain leadership from, there was no war of Medina that established him as the leader of Medina. It was through popular support that he became the leader of Medina. The Aws wal-Khazraj gave bay'ah to him, pledge of allegiance to him, and as a result they put him in that position. And he, as soon as he got leadership, he made constitutions between him and the minority groups, namely Jewish people and polytheists. And we have those documents to hand. It's not like these things are extant, not extant. They are historically extant. They are catalogued. We have them all the way back to Al-Zuhri, his Kitab al-Ghazawat. All of these things with a chain of narration, which is good, which talks about the minority rights that were granted to Jewish people. The minority is very important. We must, and put this in the notes as well, we must talk about the fact that the Prophet, and this is another charge, he's an anti-Semitic person, he killed this person. Why would he, if that was the case, make a constitutional agreement with the Jewish people when he went to Medina? And that constitution we have with us. In fact, you can make an argument that the pluralism that existed in the Islamic State was more robust than the pluralism that exists in liberal states. Especially considering the fact that they were given their own courts of law that would have efficacious rule. Such a thing doesn't exist in Britain for Muslims. Like, for example, you have a Sharia council, it's not going to have efficacious law. It's, the police are not going to come and knock on your door if the fatwa that the sheikh gives is not going to be implemented. But that would have been the case for Jewish courts in Muslim countries. And this is the case. So there was an element of a strong element of pluralism that existed. And there was a strong element of national identity based on religion, of not compulsion of religion, all these things. And protection, explicit, express protection that was given. So I think these points are very important. Because one of the things that's held, or he's anti-Semite. But when the Quran talks about itself, the Quran talks about the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his interaction with, for example, Banu Nadir and Banu Qurayza. ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّهُمْ شَاقُوا اللَّهُ وَرَسُولَهُ. That is because when he mentions in the first couple of verses, the excesses, يُخْرِبُونَ بِيُوتَهُمْ بِأَيْدِيهِمْ وَأَيْدِي الْمُؤْمِنِينَ فَاعْتَبِرُوا يَا أُولِي الْأَبْصَارِ, and so on. They destroyed their own houses and so on, all these kinds of events that took place. Then he says that is because they went against, they challenged the Allah and His Messenger. It doesn't say that it can be endahum Yahud. It's because they were Jewish. Why is it always the case when Allah, He speaks about fighting groups of people who are not Muslim, it's couched in language of justification, and it's to do with their actions? If it doesn't say that because they were Jewish, they were ethnically Jewish or whatever, it doesn't say anything like this. So the charge of anti-Semitism is a flatly false one, especially considering, and this is one of the most important things you can, because this discussion of anti-Semitism will keep coming up, but this is the nail, we talked about one thing, this will be the nail in the coffin now, especially considering the Prophet married a Jew. That's it. Safiya bint Huyay was a Jewish woman. She came from Huyay bin Akhtab, who was a Jewish man. She was ethnically Jewish, and she was one of those people who the Prophet married. And not only that, when she was being harassed for her Jewishness, the Prophet gave her words to say which exalted her honor. Namely, that I come from the lineage of Harun. So if it was a matter of anti-Semitism, when she came to complain to the Prophet, right, that, oh, you know, these women are telling me about I'm a Jew and so on, he would have said to them, oh yeah, they're right about that. You know, it's true, you are Jewish, you know. And it made some maybe agreed with it. But why did he give her words to defend herself, which would exalt her ethnic status, if he was such an anti-Semite? These are important things. And the point that you made about racism or anti-racism is an extremely important point. Because there is, I'll tell you this explicitly, and I've challenged people with this. There is no equivalent of la fadla hadith, which is there's no virtue of a black man over a white man, or a white man over a black man, or an Arab over a non-Arab, or a non-Arab over an Arab, in any world religion. In any ancient world religion. Obviously, you can, when I say ancient here, we have to, obviously you can say this feminism, whatever, religion, or Scientology. We're talking about ancient world religions, yeah? There is no equivalent. There's not one verse in the Bible, the Old Testament, that explicitly condemns racism. You'll never find, in fact, the New Testament in itself could be said to have things inside of it which indicate racism itself. Jesus saying to the Gentile woman who came, that I don't, you know, it's not for the dogs to come and, you know, he referred to her as a dog. Because she was a Gentile, she was a non-Jew. Now this, in modern parlance, would be seen as racist. Discriminatory. But you don't find anything equivalent. Imagine this was in the Quran. Imagine this was in the Hadith. Imagine for a second that you had the equivalent of a non-Arab man coming to the Prophet, and the Prophet referring to them as a dog. Please imagine. Please imagine what they would do with that. So, Islam is clearly the most anti-racist religion in the face of the earth. Clearly. And for that reason, it's the most multicultural religion in the face of the earth. And it's the only religion which takes a stance the way it does on these issues. So much so that we talk about Bilal, the black man, who married Hala bint Auf, by the way, who's an Arab. But there's more than that, like Osama bin Zayd, he was black as well. He had black skin, literally had black skin. And the Prophet made him a leader of armies. He loved him, actually, because his father was Zayd ibn Haritha, who was, as you know, right? So the idea of race is a very important one. Tribe is a very important one. Because the Prophet Muhammad was able to unify the tribes. No one else before him could do that. The Quran says that itself. You know, that you أَلَّفْتَ بَيْنَ قُلُوبِهِمْ. That you had, that Allah had وَأَلَّفَ بَيْنَ قُلُوبِهِمْ, that he made their hearts united. وَلَوْ أَنْفَقَتَ مَا فِي الْأَرْضِ مَا أَلَّفْتَ بَيْنَ قُلُوبِهِمْ. And if you had put all your money into this project, you would not have been able to, from the whole world, make them united. It was only a spiritual and religious incentive that made them united. And then you have the charge once again of the Prophet being war hungry and power hungry. Because they say, fine, maybe he was not money hungry. Maybe it wasn't a woman thing, but maybe it was about power. Power hungry. So why is it then, when he met, in Hudaybiyah, when he was trying to go into to do Umrah with the Sahaba, with the companions, he criticized that. This is very interesting. He criticized them for being war hungry. He says, "Wayhaka Quraysh." He says, "Woe to you, Quraysh! Laqad akalatkum al-harb." That war has devoured you. He said, "War has devoured you." So if he was the one on the one who wanted war all the time, then why is he criticizing the opposition for wanting war? In fact, he went there to do a peace treaty, and this shows you the pragmatism that you're talking about. Hudaybiyah is the best bedrock example in the seerah for compromise with the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now, and this, they use Hudaybiyah, fuqaha, the jurisprudence, the jurists, they use it to show that you can have peace treaties with any nation you want. Islam is not a religion that doesn't want peace. That's false. If it was a religion that couldn't handle peace, had no propensity for peace, or couldn't deal with peace, then Hudaybiyah would have been out of the question. And Hudaybiyah is one of the most bedrock examples of where Islam is not only capable of peace, but is calling for it on a military and geopolitical level. And who broke Hudaybiyah's agreement? It was them. It was the enemy tribes who broke Hudaybiyah. And when it broke, and Fath Mecca took place, when the Prophet could have gone in and slaughtered everybody, those people who had been torturing and persecuting, and he could have done all of that. But when he went into Mecca, he went in, and the narrations say that his head was on parallel with the horse's head, meaning he was arched over in humility. He wasn't pomp like maybe I would be going in like some kind of professional wrestler. There was no, it's human nature. When you beat someone, you see it in the MMA, you see it in this and that. You raise your arms and, you do this. It's a human impulse. You're so excited. It's a psychological reaction. The Prophet was not into this dunya stuff. He was not into this worldly stuff. Can you imagine? Such a victory, bro. Such a victory that for years and years, 10 plus 13, we're talking like 20 plus years, that he's fighting against these people, war after war. Ibn al-Qayyim says 19 wars. 19. 19 times you could have been killed. 19 times you were maimed or hurt or injured. Your brethren were killed. Your family members were killed. So many people died. And you finally get to that stage where you conquer this city, not through fighting, but through just walking in, because they know that they're the dominant force. They didn't fight. And you do so in such a humble way. That, wallahi, it's that in and of itself is that this is not just us. It's not lip service when we say that he has impeccable character. This is the reality, because we can see it through his actions. And it was those actions, you talk about Salah ad-Din, that exactly stopped Salah ad-Din from going in and doing the same thing. He thought about that. Because if you look at the Crusades history, the Crusades, when they came in, they destroyed everybody. Look at the reports. It's not even reports from Muslims. They came in and they slaughtered men, women and children, as the Bible talks about in the Old Testament. They slaughtered them, destroyed them. That kind of stuff you see in the Old Testament, you'll never find in the Quran. Go in and kill the women, the children, the oxen, the sheep. Kill everything that breathes. Literally, this is a verse in the Bible. The blood was ankle deep. That's what they say. This is what historians say. The blood was ankle. Can you imagine that? Like children were decimated. Now it was Salah ad-Din's turn. And he said the same thing that the Prophet said, لَا تَثْرِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الْيَوْمِ, which is that there's no blame on you today. You're forgiven, basically. Where did Salah ad-Din get this impeccable character? And this, he got it from the Prophet Muhammad. The same thing with Umar ibn Khattab. He could have gone to Jerusalem and fought and killed everybody. The Prophet predicted that Jerusalem would be overtaken. And we'll talk about this more when we talk about prophecies, yeah? But when Umar ibn Khattab went in, what did he do? Did he kill the people? He told as soon as he went in, he told, and this is mentioned, by the way, by Thomas Walker Arnold in The Preaching of Islam. It's an Orientalist book. I mean, Orientalists even admit this. Orientalists admit this. That when Umar ibn al-Khattab went into Jerusalem, he went in and he gave, he was eager, I'm paraphrasing obviously, but he was eager to give Jews and Christians their rights, to protect them, to not destroy any place of worship. This is extremely important stuff. Because the accusations that are held against Muslims are not just unjust. They are inaccurate and ahistorical. This is the reality, honestly. We need to be able to... Because these are misconceptions now. These have become fabrications. Your Prophet did this and he did that and he killed these people. Yes, there were some people that were... But the Prophet himself killed only one person in his life, by the way. In war. It was only one person. But there were wars. But they were not like the wars of, sorry, the 20th century. Like, what on earth are we comparing it to? We're talking about hundreds of people that died, maybe in all the wars. Hundreds. Hundreds of people that died. Hundreds, not even 1,000. And if we want to go liberal, then maybe 1,000 to 2,000. But, liberal estimate. How are you going to compare that to the excess, the bloody excesses of the 20th century? 30 million, 40 million. Like, let's make a comparison. A few people, 100 people died in tribes, in skirmishes and fights and so on. In mostly, and I say this, mostly defensive wars versus 30 million that died. Oh, your religion causes this and causes that. Which causes what, really? Nationalism caused 30 million death. It was national imperialism. Your version of nationalism. Power hungry. This is not the same thing. Where the Prophet ﷺ very explicitly said, ماذا لو خلوا بيني وبين سائر الناس. Like this is in the same hadith when he said, ويحق قريش لقد أكلتهم الحرب. That woe to Quraysh, that the war has overtaken them. He says, what would it have disadvantaged them if they just let me go to the people and speak to them, basically give da'wah to them, basically proselytize them, basically bring them to the religion of Islam. Meaning that the only reason for this in the first place was to have access to people so you can tell them about Tawheed. Tell them about the religion of Islam and Abraham, Moses and Jesus. It wasn't to acquire wealth and to acquire treasures and so on. And he wasn't a beneficiary to any of that. He lived a life of poverty. And do you know, one other thing I want to add. The Prophet Muhammad, we said he had 19 wars. But that's Ghazawat, not Saraya, by the way. Not the small skirmishes. He lived in this poverty, 9 wives, all of these things, difficulties, yeah? Religious rulings in the morning. He had as an obligation that he were to pray the whole night, sorry, 2/3 of the night or half a night, or 1/3 of the night. Can you imagine, like we pray 5 times a day, imagine spending, let's count it, let's say 3 hours a day, just standing up and praying. I can't handle that, sorry to say. Can't handle that even in Ramadan. 3 hours is a long time. We do Taraweeh 1 hour. Imagine times that by 3 and make it 365 days a week. Plus fasting, plus wives, and plus fighting. Sorry, man. This is too much. No, what imposter can keep that up? I want you to think about that. What imposter can keep up the fact that they have to pray 2/3 of the night, or 1/3 of the night, or half of the night, as the Quran states, yeah? نِصْفَهُ أَوْ انْقِصْ مِنْهُ قَلِيلًا أُزِدْ عَلَيْهُ وَرَتْلُ الْقُرْآنَ تَرْتِيلًا. Yeah, you know, half of it, or 1/3 of the night, or 2/3 of the night, like that range. You're praying, you're standing up. Your legs are cracking from the pain, and so on. And you're still in prayer for that long. And it's obligatory upon you. Because the Quran says, نَافِلَةً لَكْ. نَافِلَةً here means, it's here for him, it's obligatory. So he had to pray that much. And someone say, well, how do we know he did that? Every single one of his wives were witness to that. Yani, it couldn't be that all 9 of his wives, and this is one of the wisdoms of having 9 wives, came together and colluded that, yeah, we're going to have to uphold this lie that he prayed 1/3 of the night, or you know? And all the community members that saw him pray, other community members saw that, yani, let's uphold this lie in this tacit collusion that we all have together, and we'll all uphold this lie. No, he prayed this long. People saw it, even his wives, people that he was traveling with, he was with, they saw that stuff. So what kind of imposter would that have to be? it would be in a level of motivation that is not explicable through human means. You're praying two-thirds of the night, you're putting your life on the line, you're living on dates and water, you're sleeping on straws, you're eating scraps, and somehow this is all a lie. Somehow you made it all up. It doesn't seem right. Just by looking, and this is why the Prophet ﷺ himself is a bayina. Himself, that's his life is an evidence. Why do you think the people that were with him and believed in him, why do you think they were so certain, like Abu Bakr as-Siddiq, that he was on the haqq? Because they knew about him, they knew about his life. There's no chance that this guy is, this man here, there's no chance that he's making this up. There's no chance that he's an imposter. There's no chance. Just based on his character alone. Now, with the person next to you, actually, with that we conclude. Yes, we'll do more interactive stuff, but we, what we're going to do, inshallah, for Monday's lesson, I want you to produce, and I'm going to, I know that some of you have already written something for the previous thing that I set. I will be looking at that as well, inshallah. So add, whoever's finished that, please give it to me. It's optional, you don't have to give it, but this one I do want everyone to do. Even if it's, it'll take 5 minutes of your time. Based on everything that everyone has said today in this brainstorm, and what I said as well, we need to redo the 3 minutes. Yeah? Everyone's going to redo the 3 minutes because we want to make it as gold standard as possible. If someone asks you this question, it's one of the most important questions you can ever be asked about the Prophet Muhammad. We follow him. You know, we follow him. He's the final prophet. So for us, we need to be able to be on point and give the answers that will basically be the most pertinent, salient points about his life, which indicate his genuinity. Yeah, which indicate his legitimacy, as you mentioned. It's a good word they used, Muadh. So let's think together and we'll put these points, inshallah, and on Monday we'll go further. And also read the K by H thing on my website, the 10 points, okay? Because we're going to be talking about evidences now, because we haven't even gotten into evidences. We haven't gotten into prophecies or history or linguistic or structural. We haven't even started that yet. And look already how convincing it is. Like, we haven't even started the evidences, and look how convincing this thing is, just by the Prophet's character itself, which we have underexplored. Let's be honest about it, in the dawah. We have not given it as haqq. So, any questions on that? Alright. With that, we conclude, inshallah ta'ala, and we'll see you in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.